The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The CIA and other agencies are seeing this activity by Russia. They're responding to it and they're thinking, wow, this is a much bigger deal than anything we've ever seen in an election or in any kind of endeavor in American life. And then they're seeing Trump's behavior and they're worried that things could be much worse than even they are beginning to understand through all of this intelligence that's flowing in. I mean, it's really easy to understand, I think, in hindsight, why they were so panicked, why John Brennan in August of 2016 holes up in the seventh floor in his office for 2 days, just shuts the door and goes through all of the agency's intel on Russia and comes out of that sort of shaken and calls the White House and says, I need to speak with the president immediately.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 12th, 2019. Last week, Jack Goldsmith got on the phone with Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post journalist Greg Miller to discuss Miller's new book, The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Miller's book chronicles Russia's efforts to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and the interactions among members of the Trump campaign, transition and administration, and officials and representatives of the Russian government. Goldsmith and Miller discussed how Miller approached writing the book, the extraordinary series of apparent connections and contacts between Trump associates and the Russian government, and what Russian President Vladimir Putin might have gained from his brazen interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 381, Greg Miller on The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy.
So I'm here with Greg Miller to talk about his book, The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Greg, thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
So the book is amazing because it takes the dozens of disparate strands of what I will call the Russian influence operation on the American election and all of the collateral activity and brings it together into one coherent, even novelistic story that just kind of marches and sings and makes everything make sense. So tell the process about how you put all this stuff together and what were the takeaways from bringing years, I guess, or almost over a year of reporting of disparate strands of information into one coherent book?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jack. I think, one of the purposes of doing the book was just basically what you laid out there, was that this story was so sprawling and it was so difficult to follow, even for those of us who were in the middle of trying to cover it at the time, that we felt like it really needed to be told in a chronological way and in a narrative way for it to make sense to people. And we had publishers coming to the Post in the middle of 2017 interested in getting Post writers to deliver a story, a book about that crazy year. And so that's sort of where this came from. For me, it was really surprisingly eye-opening to when I first sat down about a year ago now to start mapping this out and build out a very long and detailed chronology. And it ended up being 45 or so pages. Because
sorry, that was just a chronology of events?
That was just a chronology of events, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was, eye-opening to me because I would just see, as I laid things out in the sequence in which they occurred, instead of the sequence by which we learned about them, things jump out at you, connections jump out at you that wouldn't have or didn't at the time. And the best example of this to me is the instance during the campaign, the famous or infamous moment when Trump says, "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you can find these emails." And of course, now because of Mueller's work, we know that Russia was listening and that Russia's intelligence services mobilized an effort within hours to direct spear phishing attacks at Clinton computer networks.
Right. So that event is something that stood out for me also. But it highlights a puzzle for me. There are lots of puzzles that the book raises and tries to resolve. One, the puzzle that it highlights is, at the time, I thought when he said that, it was in the air that Russia was involved in trying to influence the operation in some sense. Most of the information hadn't come out. But it struck me that it couldn't really have been a signal to the Russians or an attempt to cooperate with them, that it was just Trump mouthing off like he always mouths off, because who would be foolish enough to say that in public in a way that would invite scrutiny? And I have to say, a lot of my reaction to the book is, over and over again, Trump does these crazy self-defeating things, especially in his support for Russia and his denial of the truth of what the intelligence report showed and the like, that really only hurt him. That's just a puzzle to me. How do you explain that?
It is. Moment after moment or time after time, you're right, he's doing things, making decisions, taking action that is self-defeating. I think a lot of people think firing Comey was in many ways self-defeating.
It was
His inability to see around simple corners is astonishing over and over and over again. And it remains, I think, one of the big puzzles. I think that it remains one of the big mysteries. Why does he do this? Why does he behave toward Putin the way he does? Why does he act this way in public? But that doesn't negate the fact that there are these reactions, right? I mean, there are parts in the book where I try to lay this out and say, you know, we get confused by this. It's so hard. It's so confusing for us who are people who are reporters who are accustomed to seeing politicians act certain ways and react in certain ways to scandal and so forth. It's almost impossible to process Trump's behavior sometime, and we get confused because it happens out in the open. We sort of discount it, when I think that over and over again, there have been cases in his interactions with Russia where, if they had been secret signals sent, it would have been earth-shattering. But because they play out in public, like Russia, if you're listening, we kind of rush past it or can't process it.
Right. So at first glance, it looks like it's a less effective way to communicate, and he can't mean it because who would be foolish enough to say it in public? Saying it in private, if it came out, as some things did, as you document some meetings and the like, would be much more devastating. I have to say that another thing that struck me from reading the book was, again, one gets a sense of this from newspaper reports, but seeing it all together was, it's really amazing that Page, Manafort, Papadopoulos, and Flynn all kind of ended up being his core advisors, three of them national security type advisors. All of them, as you show, have this extraordinary affinity for Russia. And it seems like an accident that they all came together, but it's really an extraordinary coincidence. And they were, as you show, as soon as they were involved in the Trump campaign, they had still had all these dealings with Ukraine and Russia and the like. That's happening at the same time that the president is really being openly pro-Russian in a way that people find shocking. Is it just a coincidence?
I mean, it probably goes beyond a coincidence to the extent that they're drawn to Russia. I think Carter Page is drawn to Trump in part because of what Trump is saying about Russia aligns with Carter Page's affection for and admiration for Russia. And they all are – they're also – you know, I guess the other common denominator for me for all of these figures is that they are schemers to one degree or another. I mean, and maybe I mean that in a slightly pejorative way, but maybe not entirely. So, I mean, they're all – I think you could make an argument that Trump himself, Mike Flynn, George Papadopoulos, Carter Page, they are all through the campaign. None of them is convinced that Trump is going to become president. But they all see their affiliation with Trump and with the campaign as possibly sort of enriching, money generating, ways to – they're looking for ways to cash in throughout this whole election cycle and positioning themselves for riches afterward, making connections along the way. They're all trying to take advantage of this. And they all think they can make money from Russia, including Trump.
Well, that's the extraordinary thing, is that not only are they schemers seeing that this campaign can be a means to riches later, but it's all kind of tied into Russia. That's the extraordinary thing.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all connected with Russia. And part of it is, that's that they're drawn to Russia for their various reasons. And they are different reasons. I mean, Flynn's attachments to Russia are different from George Papadopoulos's or Trump's. But Russia is also reaching out to them. I mean, Russia was clearly cultivating Mike Flynn for a number of years, was not to be an asset necessarily, but just to be a friendly figure in the American system. We all obviously know that Carter Page was seen as an asset, a frustrating, a maddeningly ineffective one by Russian intelligence operatives who were in New York who were interacting with him. So Russia accounts for a lot of this contact, of course.
So two other things that relate to that are powerful in the book is, one, you tell in a really great way how this looked from the Russian perspective and all the various ways that they were trying to infiltrate Trump and the United States electoral system. And at the same time, telling the story about how the U.S. intelligence community was kind of waking up to this over the course of 2016. And I don't know if you meant to do this on purpose, but you could see that they were, at least I interpreted the story you told as the intelligence community increasingly thinking, oh my God, not necessarily Trump is a Manchurian candidate, but we know that the Russians are trying to infiltrate this campaign. We see a campaign that is shockingly pro-Russia, at least given past U.S. foreign policy. And so this dawning realization that there may be a really serious problem here, not really knowing until the very end how big the problem was, and yet being hamstrung by the fact that it was a presidential campaign, that Obama didn't want to interfere. Anyway, I just thought that the juxtaposition of what the Russians were doing and how our intelligence community was responding to it in light was nicely done.
Yeah, and I think that you're right, and the CIA and other agencies are seeing this activity by Russia. They're responding to it and they're thinking, wow, this is a much bigger deal than anything we've ever seen in an election or in any kind of endeavor in American life. And then they're seeing Trump's behavior and they're worried that things could be much worse than even they are beginning to understand through all of this intelligence that's flowing in. I mean, it's really easy to understand, I think, in hindsight, why they were so panicked, why John Brennan in August of 2016 holes up in the seventh floor in his office for 2 days, just shuts the door and goes through all of the agency's intel on Russia and comes out of that sort of shaken and calls the White House and says, I need to speak with the president immediately.
And yet they were paralyzed at the same time. Is that fair?
Yeah, because they don't want to. I mean, as for all that Trump has accused these agencies, whether it's the CIA or the FBI, of trying to run informants or wiretapping him, in fact, it's the opposite. This is sort of a radioactive territory for them. They don't want to push too hard in those months, in the final months of the campaign, for the exact reason you cite. They don't want it. They're terribly uncomfortable. I mean, the FBI is terribly uncomfortable trying to look at or investigate a presidential campaign in the middle of an election. And of course, the CIA, for many reasons, can't and shouldn't be looking at Trump. So they're only seeing the Russia side of the picture and trying to hand off all this information to the FBI. And the result is that they are paralyzed.
And yet they regretted it almost immediately after the election, because as you also show, the FBI and Obama and the intelligence community generally and lots of other folks were all acting implicitly on the assumption or belief that Hillary Clinton was going to win. That's one of the reasons Obama hesitated to intervene more firmly, I think you portray, because of his fear that it would seem like he was trying to tip the election to Hillary. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a... As we said, there throughout this book, there are all these moments where you just sort of look at it in hindsight now, and you think, how could they have been so stupid? But this is one of the biggest problems, I think, that cuts across many categories and affected many individuals' judgment. this fatally flawed assumption that Hillary was going to win. It affects Obama when he's deciding whether or not to tell the American public what Russia's doing. It affects them in terms of their response to the Obama administration in terms of its response to Russia, because they don't feel like they need to retaliate for what Russia is doing during the election, because they're convinced that Hillary's going to be able to come along later and clean up this mess when she is in office. It affects Jim Comey, and he sort of admits this in his book and in his speaking engagements since leaving office. That affects his decisions and what he does in terms of revealing publicly the extent to which the Bureau was looking at or not looking at Hillary Clinton's emails. It cuts in, it goes in so many different directions.
So switching to another paradox, what I viewed as a paradox that the book raises. So this is what happened in the 2016 election, as you show, was a huge victory, just unimaginable success for Putin, the master manipulator, I think you call him. You say that he sabotaged Hillary Clinton, he helped install someone whom he wanted, and yet you also show that it hasn't been that much of a success for Putin, because he hasn't gotten the policy changes he wanted. Trump has been kind of checked on all fronts from his efforts to have better relations with Putin. Do you still think it's a victory for Putin?
Yeah, I think it's a huge victory for Putin. I think it's one of the biggest accomplishments, intelligence sort of operations-wise in recent history. And yet, I think that that's right. You have to, when you look at it, you have to sort of divide it into two categories: the sort of short-term transactional stuff, the basic shopping list that Russia had. What it would really want from an American president or a new administration, it's gotten very little of. And in fact, things have only gotten worse in terms of the sanctions that they face economically and otherwise. But if the bigger goal, and I think that this is where the intelligence community is on this issue, the bigger goal for Russia was to damage American democracy, to damage America's reputation in the world, to hurt its alliances, to bring it down more than a notch or two in its standing. And that has happened, right? I mean, if you look at the damage to critical alliances, to NATO, to the way the United States is viewed by its longstanding allies, and it's been hugely successful from Putin's perspective.
And that's simply by virtue of having Trump as president acting as he is. But beyond that, I think the biggest impact seems obvious is not just that Trump won, but you could say that the ongoing investigation in the Congress and by Mueller and the political divisiveness that has caused is a continuing happy consequence for Putin of the information operation.
Yeah, I mean, we're just as a country, we're tied up in knots. We've spent a year and a half, nearly 2 years now, investigating the president. We still don't know all of the answers we need to know. We have strained alliances all over the world. We have retreated into sort of a nationalist space. And, you know, we have a president who routinely excuses autocratic behavior, whether it's Russia doing what it does, or whether it's Saudi Arabia killing a journalist like Jamal Khashoggi.
So one of the puzzles in the book, another puzzle is, and this you close on this, I don't know if you want to talk about it since it's how the book closes, but you know, what does Putin have on Trump? Why is Trump so drawn to him? You have several theories throughout the book. One is that he's just envious of his authoritarianism. I think one is that Trump just doesn't like being told what to do, and everyone tells him not to like Russia, so he's going to double down and like Russia. That's him breaking free in his press conference after he was told over and over again not to be nice to Putin in Helsinki. But at the end, I think the theory you float is that what Putin really has on Trump is that that Trump won because of him, that he intervened, and that Trump owes his victory to him. Is that a fair take on how you come on your conclusion?
I think so, and I reach that conclusion through logic as much as anything else, right? I mean, throughout Trump's presidency, there's this question, and I get it all the time: What does Putin have on Trump? Is it this tape of Trump consorting with prostitutes in a Ritz-Carlton or something like that? And, you know, you can't rule that out. That's in the Steele dossier, never been proven or disproven. It seems possible, given Trump's behavior in his life, that such a tape exists, but we don't know. What seems increasingly unlikely to me is that even if Putin had such a tape, that it would give him definitive leverage over Trump. I mean, it just, these sorts of things do not seem to bother Trump the way they are fatal to other politicians. I think that the theory and the idea of Trump's interest in and extensive financial entanglements with Russia and Russians is a much more compelling theory. I mean, there's lots of really good journalism on this. There's been lots of good information turned over by investigators on how many, the surprisingly large share of Russian oligarchs and Russian money that has flowed into Trump properties around the world. And of course, Trump himself has recently had to acknowledge that he was pursuing a business deal in Moscow deep into the 2016 race. So, I mean, he clearly would love to get sees money as a huge motivation there. But ultimately, you know, what Putin does have is he is sort of the last thing that Trump points to in terms of this fiction that Russian interference wasn't real. Trump says this over and over, and one of the few slender pieces of evidence he provides is, look, Putin denies it. I believe him. If Putin stopped denying it, Trump would be left virtually alone, the last person making this argument.
I'm sure he wouldn't want that to happen, but that can't be an explanation for his Russia love in 2016, 2015. You think that's more in the that's more of an explanation now for, you know, as you say, his continuing piece of evidence that there was no collusion.
His refusal to back down. You're right. Yeah. Right. And this is another area, Jack, where it's, you know, as you pointed out at the start of this podcast, it's so damaging to him, right? I mean, his reputation as president, his standing with the American public, he could arguably improve it enormously if he were to stand up to Putin in Helsinki or in any other setting, and he can't bring himself to do it.
Yeah. But let me ask you about that, and then I want to move on to some, in another direction. Let me ask you about that, because I think Trump has really been this is not an insightful point, but his own worst enemy, as we were discussing earlier. You know, Barack Obama in 2009, he comes into office. He makes an approach to one of America's traditional enemies that's engaged in terrorist operations against U.S. interests. I'm thinking about Iran. He wants to reverse our traditionally adversarial relationship with them. There were lots of secret meetings. He says things that people on the right, and he did things that people on the right viewed as almost treasonous. I'm sure that word was used. And yet I'm talking about his attempt to warm relations with Iran and do the Iran deal and the like. Nixon did a similar thing with China. We normally think that it's a presidential prerogative to change direction in foreign policy, even embracing enemies. It's not the first time this has happened. And so Trump might have been trying to do that, but he was just so horribly unsuccessful at it. And he was his own worst enemy. Is there anything to that? I mean, is there a case to be made that there was a sliver of this that Trump really genuinely believed he wanted to restart with Russia, and he was foiled from doing so by all these forces?
I think so. I think that, you know, on all these other cases that you described, and you're right that there were plenty of critics of Obama's efforts to restart a relationship with Iran, of course, and George W. Bush obviously started off seeking a warmer, improved relationship with Vladimir Putin. Neither of those presidents were elected or came through an election in which Russia was interfering on their behalf. So I mean, Trump is so blind to the optics of this, which is one of the other mysteries, right? Like, if he really wanted to reward Russia, he would have to behave almost directly opposite to the way that he has. Right. He would have to sound and posture as tough on Russia and tough on Putin to gain the political maneuvering room he needs to lift sanctions or do whatever it is he really wishes he could do.
Yeah. This could just be another example of either his incompetence as an executive, which he clearly is, or just what you said earlier, that he just can't, the one thing he can't do is to, I just don't think he can be tough on them because of the election, because of what it entails for his legitimacy. I think that's haunted him from the day of the election.
What it would require for him to admit, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that also jumped out, and this has been true in other reporting, but it jumped out here in some different ways, is how much extraordinary resistance there's been to the president from within his administration, not just by bureaucrats, but also by his own appointees on Russia policy. And I was also struck by the passage where you said, you talked about secure drop and how you get anonymous information and you get a lot of it from the government, but most of it doesn't pan out, but it's just been rushing out in this administration. Is that a fair account? And I'm just wondering what does it say about the deep state story? I mean, it seems like that the story you tell, both in telling the story of who's resisting Trump from within and also from, as you put it, the masses, unprecedented masses of information and leaks to tell what's going on, and it's been behind, I think, a lot of your amazing reporting, is the result of this unusual bureaucratic output. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think that there's a misunderstanding, though, Jack, about aspects of this, and I'm glad you raised it. You know, the book does go, I turn the camera back on ourselves from time to time in the book and looking inside right. The Washington Post newsroom and how stories unfold and who was getting what and how editors here were making decisions about going forward with stories at these sort of gut-wrenching moments. And it's true that there has been just a torrent of leaks from this administration. And of course, a lot of that is, again, Trump's fault because he does not engender loyalty in the way that most people do, or most presidents do. So, I mean, he turns on everybody and spits on them constantly when they leave. I mean, there's just no expectation that he's going to be loyal to anyone. And so there is less incentive for them to be loyal to him. But I think there's a misconception that there is this deep state that is sort of, you know, Obama holdovers who are scattered across the government who account for all of the damaging information that has surfaced about Trump and his administration. And I can tell you that that's just not the case. That a lot of the most damaging information has come from Trump people inside the White House. And you can see it week after week, just the number of people in the White House who are talking to reporters at the Post and other news organizations. It's just a reality. A lot of it is not political either. It's sort of professional people who are aghast at what's happening to whatever corner or job they occupy in government, aghast at what they're witnessing and being subjected to or exposed to, and trying to figure out a way to call attention to it.
Let me push back on that just a little bit. I didn't mean to suggest that I should have said deep state in quotes. I didn't mean to suggest that this was rear guard Obama action at all. Mm-hmm. I do think that there is a kind of elite professional national security establishment that transcends administration. Some of them work as political actors, some of them work as bureaucrats, but they're all kind of in the same club and they transcend administrations. And I do think, rightly or wrongly, that they are all aghast at this. And I do think that, and I, of course, obviously a lot of these damaging leaks are coming from Trump's own people, some of whom I put in that camp, by the way. Mm-hmm. But you just said that it's professional, it's not political, but I mean, the problem is that the President of the United States was elected, although I guess that's contested here too, and is trying to come in his ham-handed, horrible way and change policy. And of course, there are all these legal questions along the way. So I'm not at all defending what he did because he's been his own worst enemy. But there has been this concerted effort to, and really unprecedented leaks. And it's not the kind that you talked about, but leaks are commonplace in Washington. I don't, you know this business much better than I, but the types of foreign intelligence information that have come out, actual contents of FISA intercepts, reporting on U.S. persons information in FISA intercepts, that stuff is all unprecedented, and it's been growing under Trump. And so I think it's hard to deny, but I'm happy for you to deny it or disagree with me, that there's been a kind of concerted establishment effort both outside and inside the administration to stop him. Now, maybe, let me just say one more thing. Maybe it's because they disagree with this policy. Maybe it's because they think he's running the country. Maybe it's because they think he's acting illegally. I don't know, but I think it's hard to deny that that's happened, isn't it?
I think that's right. I think that's fair. I'll be honest. I've never lived through anything like this. I've never seen anything like it. I've been covering Washington since 2001, and I think most of my colleagues would say the same. And I think that it's actually evolved, even within this short sort of Trump administration timeframe. I mean, if you look at the first big story that we did at the Post on Trump Russia, it was the Mike Flynn story. It was what it was his lie. It was his claim that he had not discussed sanctions with the Russian ambassador when in fact he had. Now, when you look at the way that that is exposed, you know, first David Ignatius writes a column in the Washington Post saying, look, Mike Flynn had this conversation with the Russian ambassador. The timing sure looks problematic. The American public deserves an explanation for what he was talking about with the Russian ambassador on the same day that Obama is implementing sanctions against Russia. You know, days later, you have the vice president, you have the incoming White House spokesperson going before the American public and relaying what and repeating Flynn's lie, saying they didn't discuss sanctions. And there are people in government who know that that's not true. People in and out of government who know that that's not true. And when you have an administration starting off on a lie that big and that consequential, it's, you know, it's inevitable that the motivations for those people to want to expose that lie is off the charts.
No, I agree. And it comes against the background, of course, of all of the intelligence information about the Russian influence operation in 2016. So it's completely understandable. I mean, I get that. Let me add, do you think, by the way, what are the chances that I think one of the big unknown questions is whether Trump directed Flynn to lie, and which would be an overt obstruction of justice, unlike a lot of the other things I think that he's been charged with. Do you have any insight into that?
I have not seen any evidence of that, nor have I ever talked to anybody who said they've seen any evidence that Trump directed that. Of course, that's been a core question all along.
Yeah.
We know that
yeah.
Flynn consults with the Trump team in Mar-a-Lago in leading up to that fateful conversation with Kislyak. We don't know how high that goes. We don't know what Trump knew.
Right. So let's talk briefly about Rod Rosenstein, who comes off really interestingly in the book. So I think you tell a story more than it's been told before about his real, tell me if this is a fair way to put it, his real kind of enthusiastic complicity in drumming up, in being anti-Comey and in helping come up with a justification for removing Comey, while at the same time not knowing that the memo he wrote was going to be used in the way that it did, and thus being shocked when Trump, basically pinned the blame on the Rosenstein memo. Is that a fair characterization? It seemed like, not only to get to what he did after that, but it seemed like he was being one of the boys, so to speak, in the meetings where people were coming up with reasons why Comey should be fired.
Yeah, this is another great example, and I devote several chapters of the book to this whole period of that story because it's so fascinating to me that here you just have so many characters, super smart people who seem so shockingly easy to manipulate. And Rosenstein is one of them. He is leading the charge to get rid of Comey. He is as angry as anybody else in the Justice Department over Comey's decision to announce unilaterally that there is nothing to prosecute in the Clinton email case. Rosenstein is not the only one troubled by that, and you know that better than anyone, Jack. But Rosenstein is bothered enough by that he thinks Comey deserves to be fired. And when he sees this opportunity in the Oval Office, I mean, he's all in. He does not see around the corner. First, he doesn't see around the corner how his willingness to put a memo together for all the reasons why Comey should be fired would be used. And that's just so astonishing to me. And then Trump fails to see how his hanging this decision on Rod Rosenstein could potentially hurt him. Why it would not be in the president's best interest to have an enraged, bitter deputy attorney general who feels like he's been duped.
And then I think this is my characterization, not necessarily yours, but it's almost as if when a couple of weeks later, Rosenstein, who was humiliated by that episode, a couple of weeks later, when he appointed Bob Mueller a special counsel and Trump's whole world turned upside down, I mean, you didn't say it this way, but I almost interpreted that as an act of retaliation or revenge by Rosenstein. I mean, he was as a way of kind of asserting his integrity again. Is that fair?
Yeah. And the way he plays that the way he makes that play is fascinating because, you know, he's supposed to go to the White House with Sessions for a meeting with Trump. He bows out at the last minute. Basically saying he's got something else he's got to deal with, waits for Sessions to get over there to the White House, and then sets this in motion. Appoints Mueller, calls Sessions at the White House, pulls him out of the Oval, tells him, I just made this decision, we're going to have a special counsel now, leaves it to Sessions to go back into the Oval to tell Trump and deal with the mushroom cloud reaction. I mean, So, I mean, the way Rosenstein handles that, it suggests that he took very carefully orchestrating all of this. And why wouldn't he take some significant satisfaction about turning the tables on Trump and Sessions?
Yeah, and yet it's amazing because he's the deputy attorney general working under Sessions and appointed by Trump. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So one of the, I think it's fair to say, but again, disagree if you want, that I mean, the reporting inside of institutions from Russia to throughout Europe to all over Washington and elsewhere is amazing. But the one nut you didn't seem to crack very much was the Mueller team itself, although you give a great account of it. Do you have, and first of all, I wonder if you can comment on that at all. And then do you have any sense, I'm switching to prognostication now. Do you have any sense of where that's going? I mean, is there any, do you have any insights based on the book or other reporting about where that's going?
Yeah, so I appreciate the question. I mean, I really tried in the book, Jack, to take people inside all of these institutions. I think I have great scenes from inside the CIA, inside the FBI, inside the White House, inside Trump's legal team, inside Congress, inside, you know, meetings, fly on the wall details from critical meetings through this timeline. But
And also in Russia, inside
the Internet Research Agency.
Right.
And you're right. I mean, the one thing I couldn't penetrate, nor and I don't think anybody else has either, is the Mueller operation. And to me, that's a fascinating characteristic and trait of Mueller and his team. To me, it's like one of the things I tried to write about in the book, and is just sort of this interesting psychological contrast between Trump and Mueller. Trump, I don't know, I've lost count of how many dozens of tweets in which he's called this a witch hunt or accused Mueller of having a team of Democrats over there, and he's fixated on it and talking about it incessantly. Mueller has yet to utter a single word since taking this job in public. It's just an astonishing thing. I mean, Trump loves to drag his adversaries out in the open and pummel them in the Klieg lights, right? And Mueller gives him no surface to grab onto. Mueller is just all glancing blows.
And it's pretty clearly driving Trump crazy, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, what could be more unnerving to Trump than an adversary like that who won't engage with him in the way that he's most comfortable?
So let's just talk. I have three questions left. The first one is the significance of the House takeover by the Democrats and what the Democrats are going to do and how you think going forward that's going to impact Trump and the Russia matter, broadly speaking.
Yeah, I mean,
any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that I'm focused mostly on the House Intelligence Committee, and there's lots of committees that are dying to dig into various aspects of the Trump administration. The House Intelligence Committee, I think Adam Schiff, I think people, you know, he gets a lot of criticism. A lot of people think he's very partisan. He's also super smart. He's a former prosecutor. He's very deliberate. And he has got a smart team, and I would be surprised if he makes any missteps. I mean, you can read through transcripts of his involvement in the interviews with the various Trump officials who have appeared before the committee while Devin Nunes was running it, and you can see Adam Schiff just running circles around them. And I think, you know, I know from talking to him and his staff that they're interested in areas that have not gotten a lot of attention so far. They're interested in digging into the Trump connections to Deutsche Bank, which of course is this huge German bank that has its own entanglements with Russian oligarchs. They are interested in getting people like Jared Kushner and Trump Jr. back before the committee to testify again in a completely different setting than when Devin Nunes was running the committee. I expect them to be aggressive, and I expect that we will learn a great deal from what their efforts.
And yet the early returns, to me, it seems that Trump maybe is fearful of this, but already in his early clashes with Pelosi, it seems like he might enjoy it. And at some level, I mean, how do you think he'll respond? How will he conduct himself in reaction to what are going to be super aggressive, super intrusive investigations?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we're in for a white knuckle ride that the likes of which we've never really seen, because Trump doesn't have the same regard for institutions that any president we've ever known, including Nixon, right? I mean, Nixon in some ways was reverent of American democracy and of its institutions compared to Trump. So what does a president who has so little concern for the traditions of our government do and act when cornered? And I don't know how that's going to play out, but I imagine it could be devastating in some ways. I just don't know where he would draw the line. What would he not do if it came to it to protect himself or his own or his interests?
I predict not much that he can imagine.
Yeah.
So the biggest issue, my last question is this, the biggest issue, I think the big picture issue raised by your book and the entire episode that you cover is whether the U.S. government and U.S. democracy can deal with these foreign information operation threats. You described the Russia operation in great detail in its many strands. It wasn't that sophisticated, and it wasn't that hard, in my judgment, to do what they did. One thing we haven't talked about that you talked about in great detail in the book was the social media companies and their role in this and how they were manipulated to amplify a lot of the information operation. But it seems to me that our defenselessness on cyber, which I think is going to be just where we're going to be for a long time, combined with our free speech society, combined with deep political divisiveness, and combined with the ease with which foreign governments can infiltrate our politics and how that infiltration itself sparks increased divisiveness, I came away from the book pretty discouraged. Is that the right reaction or the wrong reaction?
I think it is. I worry about that a lot. And it's, you know, we had grown accustomed to seeing our technological dominance as a society as a strength, as something that gave us power, soft power, and other kinds of power over much of the rest of the world. And what Russia did and what Russia showed us was that sort of inverted that and turned it into an asymmetric vulnerability. And because of so much of it is structural, as you point out, because we are an open society, because these are open internet companies, Facebook, Twitter, and so forth, whose business models depend on maximizing the number of users and maximizing sort of exposure, I don't know how you batten down the hatches in a way that you would need to make us immune to this kind of interference in the future. I think you can educate people. You can make people smarter about what's real and what's not, what's fake and what's not. I think that the government's trying and making some progress in this regard. But, you know, here again, you can only go so far as a government in addressing these issues if the commander-in-chief calls it all a fake and a hoax, right? You can't mobilize a meaningful government effort when the president himself is constantly sowing doubt about whether any of this is real.
And that was even a factor in the 2016 election when the intelligence community approached the Hill trying to get some consensus on a statement, and the Republicans, rightly or wrongly, they viewed it as political, as the Democrat-dominated intelligence community trying to hurt the Republican president's chances. And that, so the point is, that might happen no matter who is president, given the way politics are today.
Yeah, I think that's right. So in addition to us being a technology-dependent society, we're also a very fragmented society, politically fractured society. And it's really important to note that Russia didn't come up with new issues to divide us. I mean, they just sort of identified existing divisions and made them worse. And it wasn't that hard to do. It didn't, as you said it so right, it was not a very sophisticated effort. It reached 100, and I mean, Facebook has had to acknowledge now that Russia disinformation during the campaign reached more than 126 million Americans, which is roughly equivalent to the number who voted.
I'm very grateful, Greg, for you all doing this. Okay, I hope that was okay. I thought it was a good discussion.
It was. I'm really grateful for you doing this, Jack. Thanks very much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Special thanks this week to Greg Miller for coming on the show and to the Washington Post for providing this audio. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.